Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, welcome to the Autocar Podcast, My Week in Cars, with Pryor here. Steve Cropley over there. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, mate. How's it going?
Very good, thank you, mate. And between us is JLR's Matthew Becker. Hello, Matthew.
Good morning.
Special nice guest for the week. What is your job title, Matt?
So my job title is Vehicle Engineering Director for all Jaguar Land Rover products. So, yep.
It's, sounds like enough to do.
Yes, certainly. Amount of products we're doing here, there's an awful lot to do.
I'm going to ask you a question that could take 5 seconds to answer, or it might take the entire hour of the program. What do you do? What does your job entail?
Yes, I think it's going to take longer than 5 seconds. So my kind of remit is, if you think about all of the driven attributes of all of the products, I'm fundamentally responsible for leading the team that develop all those. So if you think about vehicle dynamics, no surprise, I look after the vehicle dynamics team in terms of all the development. The MVH team on the vehicle level, noise, vibration and harshness, there's a team that looks after all that to develop the, remove the unwanted noises and add the wanted noises. On top of that, we have actually the vehicle engineering team for the special vehicles has recently joined my team. We leave them in a kind of separate, more isolated team, so they have the freedom to be creative. On top of that, we have what's called, and when Mike Cross was here, he had what was called a VET team, vehicle evaluation team, and we've now changed that to product character and performance, and I've basically expanded their remit of the things they look after on the cars to develop them. On top of that, durability and robustness. I told you it would take longer than 5 seconds. Durability and robustness, which is fundamentally, as it says, it's the durability of the car, the robustness of the cars to pretty severe events, including kind of thermal properties of the car as well. On top of that, we also have all-terrain capability. We used to call it off-road capability, and the problem was with calling it off-road capability, people thought that was just about rock crawling and climbing up hills, where it isn't really. It's really dependent on what brand we're developing. It's the all-terrain capability to make sure that they achieve what they need to achieve.
Yeah.
Wow. How big is the team?
Roughly 500 people.
Wow.
Yeah. 500. Yeah, so it's all very grown up.
So presumably, yeah. I mean, we know you as a bloke who could drive better than us. You know, you remember you used to join us on our handling days and so forth. We've got an invitation for you, incidentally.
Yeah, you don't invite me anymore. I don't know what happened.
Well, so. Mate, it's hanging in the air. Presumably, do you get enrolled in lots of admin, or do you still have your hands on the steering wheel? What's life like? I mean, you just finished telling us before we started recording that you hate the office, so...
Yeah. No, so I still travel a lot, and it's not... I'm not a micromanager by any... But I do like... I like to go to the tests to support the team, and it's not to say that I go there to tell them what to do, because that's really not not the way I work. And at the end of the day, I've got a, in all these different departments, a super strong team. They're very clever people. They're very experienced. And I just go along there really to sort of nudge them one direction or the other. And it's not really, as I said, to, you know, tell them everything about what I want from the car, because, you know, a lot of these individuals are either new to me, but, you know, being 2.5 years in now, they know what I like, or they have come from other companies where they worked with me before, so they know exactly what I like.
But it is a matter of, it sounds like it is to some extent a matter of what you like.
Well, it kind of isn't it? Yes, it is, but some of the details. But I think, like I found in the previous companies I was at, and, you know, Lotus and Aston, is that very much, I think, coming to Aston, I think it took me 2 years to really understand the DNA of those products. And having that experience, when I was Lotus for 26 years and kind of jumping from Lotus to Aston was, well, you know, the size of the company was 3 times what Lotus was. So that was an eye-opener for me at that time. But it really took me 2 years to understand the DNA of those products. And you, I think what I've found is you can't rush into to trying to put your stamp on a car without learning the DNA. The DNA is super important. And then coming to JLR is spending time with the team, spending time in the products is super critical before you, I might have an opinion on, you know, I want the car to be this or this, but you have to, fundamentally, the customers that buy the cars want a certain DNA within it. So yes, it is some of my opinion, but it's actually using the intelligence and knowledge and customer level knowledge within the company that helps you direct where the cars are going.
How do you set the car's DNA or feel? I mean, does that have to happen right at the very start of?
Yeah. So when we're doing any benchmarking for any new products, or and this is common in everywhere you go, you will look at what and who your core competitors are as a starting point. And then you will evaluate those cars against your current car to understand where are we relative to those competitors. And you have to have you have to try and future-proof this as well. And it's really difficult at the moment with the change in propulsion systems as we go towards EVs. Is you have to, because a lot of cars we want to benchmark are not out yet. But you have to have the intelligence through, you know, Autocar and other magazines and other intel we have in the industry, is what are these competitors coming out with that is of interest to us. And we're fortunate as well, because we go to lots of different proving grounds, lots of different test sites. And although you're very respectful, but you can see what all your other manufacturers are developing at those test sites. So we have an indication of what we're doing, and we can sort of have a watchful eye on what they're doing as well. But very much you have to understand what your core competitors are against the models you're about to develop, and then basically take some of the good bits from those cars. But also with JLR products, for instance, like Range Rover Sport, you know, the thing that's impressed me the most is some of their off-road capability of what they can do. And you have to respect that. And then so you can't always directly compare, for instance, a Porsche Cayenne against a Range Rover Sport, because a Porsche Cayenne will do some things really, really well. But if you try and take one off-road to the extremes, you can take some of the Range Rover products, it won't be able to do it. So you have to look at, you know, the DNA, what the product needs to deliver. Take some of the good bits from the cars, which you think, well, I really like those attributes on that cars. And then how do we stitch that in and create a greater bandwidth within our products to respect it needs to be able to go on the track to do this, go on the road to be comfortable, go across a field, tow a 3.5-ton horse box, climb up a mountain.
Go around the ring.
Go around the ring, yeah. So, and fundamentally, that's why we have so many, and that's a good thing about JLR, we have so many good test facilities, well-established test facilities where we can go to and do all this testing.
This word bandwidth is a big one with Land Rover, isn't it?
It is, yeah, very much, yeah.
But they seem to have to be able to do everything these days.
They do, and that's where you need the, you know, physics is physics, but you need the technologies and the motion control logics on the car to be able to have that bandwidth and be able to allow the cars and develop the cars to do everything they need to do.
I may have asked you this a couple of months ago, is the latest Range Rover Sport SV the biggest bandwidth? I wonder if it's the biggest bandwidth of any car on sale, but is it the biggest one you've worked with?
Yeah, I'd say it is, yeah. I mean, you came to Portimao, which, by the way, when we went there before in one of my previous companies in, I think it was 2018, and it is one of my favourite circuits. Mm. And when we were looking at the different circuits that are available, I was quite pushy, but I was quite insistent that we went to Portimao because it is a really, really, really good track. And the reason is, it's not just because it's enjoyable to drive, but it is the challenges of driving that track with the elevation change, with the braking. You know the main straight where you're braking from 150 miles an hour at 1.1 g as you go into that right hand corner, and you know, you can imagine how much that is challenging the carbon brakes on the car. And we chose that, you know, basically to demonstrate how robust the car is. You know, for instance, I'm not sure if people are aware, but we did, each of those cars did about 600 laps on the same set of brake discs and pads, and we didn't change anything. And it wasn't like we did that as a surprise to us. It wasn't, because we'd done all the testing at the Nürburgring, all the testing at the different facilities that we'd been to, and we knew how capable these brakes are on that car. But also to demonstrate to you is how fun the car is. It's not, you know, a singular focused car. It basically can do that, and then it can have the on-road performance where you can feel the ride comfort, the agility in the car. And then when we go onto the off-road and we put in the off-road track there to really demonstrate this bandwidth, because it wasn't like we'd pushed it one direction. It was a track-focused track and on-road focused car. It was basically, no, it can do all of this off-road performance as well.
Yeah. Coming from 27 years at Lotus, where you have...
I left at the end of this year. I would have left Lotus 10 years ago.
Oh, really?
End of 2014 is when I left.
Cool. Yeah. That doesn't seem possible, does it?
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. But your career has gone from Lotus to Aston Martin, where you developed your first SUV,
yeah,
to then a company where you were developing a lot of them.
Yeah.
What's the challenge of that? It's presumably harder to develop a car with a huge bandwidth than it is with a small bandwidth.
It is, and just a semi-small correction there is you have to remember when I was working at Lotus.
Oh, you would have worked on other SUVs.
I can't tell you about. But because the consultancy, I mean, when I was at Lotus, my time was very much split between doing Lotus products as well as doing consultancy products. Right. And that's, we talked about how much travel we all do, is certainly when I was at Lotus, I was all over the world, America, Korea, China, Japan, doing consultancy work as well. So I had worked on SUVs before. I just could never tell you what they were. I probably still can't. Aston, yes. Yeah, so fundamentally, doing a consultancy job, you will take other people's cars and make them better. Mm-hmm. At Aston, when we did DBX, it was taking and creating a completely new platform and putting all of mine and the team's knowledge, not just me, but the team's knowledge into creating kind of the best SUV we could at that point for the focus of what that car had.
So, where does a person with your knowledge, your specialities, where do you, at what point in the car's creation do you start to get involved? Are you there when they're working out things like dimensions and suspension systems and all that stuff, or do you take the complete car? Where do you start?
Straight from concept. Because the problem is if you take a car that someone else has dimensioned and created, and Richard Parry Jones used to say this to me, you have to make sure the bracket is right before you can work on the bracket. And what he basically meant from that is the fundamentals of the car need to be correct, because otherwise there'll always be Achilles heels around the car that won't allow you to fully unlock the potential of the car. And so very much same at Aston. I mean, Lotus to an extent, because when I did Evora, that was clean sheet of paper. That was my first clean sheet of paper car I'd done. And that was taking all the knowledge from it I'd done with the Elise, and how do we make something that's as agile as Elise, more comfortable, more easy to live in on a daily basis. And so you kind of, you have to use those principles and methodology. It doesn't matter where you are, but you have to be in at the start. You really do, at the concept phase.
So they listen to you?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd say it's a balanced view. It generally is, but yeah, you have to listen to experience. And hey, I mean, it's not just me; it's the other team members around us. We're, you know, you hire good people to kind of to make you look good. It's one part of it, because you can't do everything on your own.
No,
and certainly coming to someone somewhere at the scale of JLR, you you have to have super strong team members around you, which is what I've always done, and it's my methodology. I've always done it. Did it at Aston. I've done it here.
I was speaking to somebody at Ferrari who said that the chief designer there, he'd been at the company, I think, nearly 10 years before he had a car that he had worked on from the very start as a clean sheet.
Yeah.
Because they carried over the platform's architecture twice. So he was designing a car based on an architecture before he arrived.
Yeah.
Are you working here on clean sheet stuff now? Not that I'm expecting you to tell us what it is.
No.
But are you at that... there's no car on sale from JLR now that you were at clean sheet stage, or is there?
Correct, yeah. And in the future, obviously, and I won't tell you when, but when we look at future architectures, the good thing is all the learning I've got from I mean, to be clear, anytime you do a car or a project, you get to the end and there's always something you can improve. There's always something you think, well, I wish I'd have done that, and that. And that's just learning a product, learning limitations of why certain decisions have been made. And that's why cars evolve. That's why cars get better and better and better, is because you always evolve based on knowledge. So although I'm not directly today working on a new platform, when future platforms are considered, then all of the learning and knowledge I've had of understanding the DNA, understanding where some of the limitations are with the cars, and then just pushing, you know, things evolve. You have to keep pushing forward. You can't. It's like Formula One. They don't stand still. You have to keep pushing forward.
And the things you might argue for are dimensions, wheel envelopes, tyre sizes, suspension, space for suspension.
Exactly. And certainly, you know, as I said, if you look at the different departments I look after, it's the balance between dynamics and MBH performance. It's like, okay, so, you know, you've driven big Range Rover. It's super quiet, super refined, super comfortable. But we don't stop there. We can still make everything better. We can keep pushing and pushing and pushing. But you always do get to a point where the architecture has a limitation. And then once you've developed a car for a number of years, you understand what that limitation is. And then when you get the opportunity to do a clean sheet, your paper car, you then will unlock that potential again, because you'll say, okay, well, we know certain limitation was X, and then on the next car we can unlock that because we'll do it slightly differently.
Yeah, I always wonder about standards. They seem to, especially in stuff like Range Rovers, the cars are so good that it almost seems like a bit of a fool's errand to make them better, because they're as good as, they're so good that the customers are full of admiration anyway. And you know, I'm not sure. Perhaps there's a point where you just don't have to make them quieter because they're so quiet already.
Yeah, but I mean, engineers are engineers. You can't, you know, revert back to Formula One. It's like telling an engineer you don't need to make your car any faster. That's not going to happen, is it? And the engineer mindset. And we have to be controlled by project managers, obviously, because otherwise we'd continue forever. You know, we'd never stop a project. And so, although we at times find them annoying for telling us to stop, but they have to be there to regulate, you know, because at the end of the day, you have to, you know, we have a set gateway process of where certain things need to be at certain times. And then you have to have at some point what we call pens down. You need to leave it alone there, stop fiddling with it, which most of the engineers find frustrating because they're constantly chipping away at making the cars better. So, yeah, we won't stand still.
You're right on the edge of leaving ICE cars behind and building EVs, clearly. Is that a massive change of gear, or does a lot of the stuff that you do read across?
I think a lot of, it's no secret that we're working on the new Range Rover full electric car, and certainly a lot of the traveling I've been doing lately, kind of post, so pre-Christmas and post-Christmas, is in Sweden and then in Spain, and we're you know, developing
Sweden for ice testing stuff.
Yeah, so we use that place never changes. I've been going there 25 years.
Argeplog.
Arty Blogs, yeah. So we fly in, I think the locals call
it. What's a proper pronunciation? Anybody know?
I don't know. Well, I was always Arty Blog or something like that. But when you fly into it, the locals tell me it's pronounced Arvidsjaur, which is the airport we fly into. Many people call it Arvajar, which I don't think is correct. But Arvidsjaur is how I was, because there was a guy I worked with at Lotus who helped design the Avora chassis, and he was Swedish.
And that's 100 miles away, isn't it, the airport?
Yeah, it's 100 kilometres away. Oh, yeah, right. So it's basically an hour's drive. And that place never seems to change. It's every time we go there for 20 years, it still looks the same. It doesn't change. But
am I right? The hotel's got a kind of clump of Japanese blokes in this corner and a bunch of French and people from
there's only really two or three hotels. You've got the Silver Hat and you've got the Crier, and I can't remember the other one is called, but Hornavan, that was it. So there's, yes, as you can tell, I've been there a few times. So there's fundamentally three hotels, and you do see clusters of cultures, I would say, and companies that sit together in these different hotels. But
and they all discreetly park their prototypes in away from one another, am I right?
No, it's not too bad. I mean, there's a lot of respect in the industry that if people, and I think some of this comes from the Nürburgring, because, you know, Nürburgring is an incredibly public place, and you go there and we're all in the same car park together. Everybody's bringing their cars in and out, and you sort of give this nod to the individuals that you see on a regular basis. But there's respect there. You never really walk over to their car. You never look underneath them. You never look inside the car, because there's almost like a test driver's unwritten code that you just don't, because it's they're doing their job, we're doing our job, and you sort of don't cross that disrespectful line of trying to look into their cars, because you won't want them to do it to you. So, but there is this kind of, then you do get this kind of knowledge from afar of what other people are doing, which is super interesting. So, but yeah, fundamentally, Sweden Arjeblog is what we use for slip control tuning. We also use it for durability as well. So we will do some durability development mileage of using the cars, especially on a JLR product, where they will be used quite frequently. Having just come back from a skiing trip, I just kept seeing JLR products everywhere. So right. It, for me, it was a reminder that, yes, you need to respect
that. I cut across you. I was asking you about the change from ICE to electric and whether that affects what you look for, what you do, what the standards are, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't think it does. I'm sorry, I went off piece a bit, but it's the Range Rover BEV we're developing is although it's got a different propulsion system, we're trying to look at for that, I would call it effortless progression. So the cars, because the car has instantaneous torque, and we could deploy more torque earlier, but that's not very Range Rover. You want something that has a linearity of progression through the throttle pedal and the brake pedal. And because some of the EVs I've driven is they have this amazing performance, but it almost hurts the first time you do it, because you get explosive performance.
We talk about that thing. It leaves you slightly, I don't know, it's because it doesn't get accompanied by any noise, or whether it's just physically the G-force,
yeah.
But it just feels slightly scramblingly uncomfortable at times.
It does, and you have to think when you drive a Range Rover, that's not what you're looking for, is it? Because you drive a Range Rover and it is effortless progression. And so why, just because of you've got all this torque available to you, you don't deploy it all in one go. You basically have a linearity of throttle progression that would suit the character of that car. And I guess with EVs, what they do have the ability to do is, if you do want explosive performance and you do want to change the throttle pedal calibration to give you all the torque all at once, you can do that. But that's so again, it really, for us, it opens up another opportunity, I would say.
And in terms of off-road or all-terrain capability, what you can do with an electric motor is quicker, more responsive?
It's quicker, more responsive. And some of the, and we've got a new traction control system on the car, which its ability to react to slip is 100 times quicker than what...
100 times?
100 times quicker than what an internal combustion engine can do.
That must translate into safety, mustn't it? Because the thing doesn't slip at all before.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I mean, the acceleration on a frozen leg is unbelievable. You sort of accelerate and you're like, wow, that's super impressive. Because you normally have a slip with slip control systems, you normally have a slip curve or a target slip curve. And with internal combustion engines, they have a hysteresis because the stability control system's asking the engine to reduce torque and then increase torque. And you can imagine with an electric motor, its ability to do that is so much faster. It was 100 times faster than what an internal combustion engine can do. and therefore the smoothness of control is that much greater.
Do you have any thoughts about, I mean, my memory of you and your dad, and forgive me, but it's just developing these cars with huge amounts of character and, you know, engines round the red line and all the stuff we remember from the Lotus handling track. Do you find yourself looking back over your shoulder and wondering about cars with noise and cars with sort of old school analog responses, or have you just moved out of that?
No, I still do, because you still that does give you a level of engagement and enjoyment in a car when you drive cars like that. But I quite often, people will ask me to drive older or historic cars. I'm probably shooting myself in the foot here, but every time I drive them, I think, well, it's not very good because I don't like this, and then you drive a more modern car and they are so much better. Do they lack some of the character? Perhaps. But you've just got to be clever the way you add that character in. Yeah. I think that's
that is a thing that happens to us, isn't it? You know, you suddenly noticed the brakes weren't very good and the gear change was pretty slow.
Yeah.
It's a two-way street.
It is, and things evolve, and I'm all about looking into the future and trying to continue to make things better and more interesting. And I think that's the challenge to the engineers as well.
With an increase in electronics, can you work later into a vehicle program than you would have done?
Yes. Yeah, we can. I mean, we're very fortunate here, and I know other companies do it as well, is because we have software over the air. We have the ability to, you can't do everything. There's still limitations of how much changes you can make, but it certainly makes the deployment of attribute improvements and any other software updates will improve the kind of robustness of the cars. We have the ability to do that later, but it has to be regulated because there are cybersecurity regulations that you can't just every week keep popping updates over the air to customers. And, you know, my own company car, Range Rover Sport, very lucky, got an SV. You quite often will get in the car every month or two and it's super clever. You've got basically two antennas on the roof and it's downloading the latest software without you realizing. Mm-hmm. And when you stop the car, you may have experienced it. It says update available. So lock the car, press update now. And then you won't always see the updates it's done, because some of them are probably quite hidden, but there are subtle character changes we can make to the car.
Do you ever notice anything?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. Maybe more certain updates, I know what's coming when, and I will feel. Sometimes you'll get graphical differences where new either regulations or something different has come in that has been improved. So software over the air is a super powerful tool. It really is.
Yeah, it must.
Fantastic for housekeeping, apart from anything else, you know, not having to drag everybody to a dealership.
But yeah, that's the problem. It's super expensive to, you know, you imagine what dealerships charge per hour to drag cars in on a regular basis. And again, it's not the modern way now. It's basically, it's like your iPhone. Your iPhone is continuing every week, months. You get an iPhone 17.4-1 updated on my phone last night. So it's a similar, you know, it's a similar format now what we call software-defined vehicles. Cars are getting more and more defined by software.
The advantages of it are large, but also, once you've sold a car, you've still not finished.
No. This is your point, isn't it? You've said this before.
Well, there's two ways I think about it. Is one thing that JLR doesn't do, to my knowledge, which is the subscription thing for features. Mm. Because once you've bought the car, I'm sort of the view that it's yours.
Yeah.
I have paid for it.
He gets to
get a bit. So if somebody says, well, you need to pay me for heated seats, 30 quid a year, I think, no, hang on.
Yeah.
But just from a sheer personnel point of view, you know, 20 years ago, you would hand over a car and that effectively, apart from fixing it, was it. But now that is not...
No, and I see it as a positive because although you say it's not finished, I think it's continuous improvement. For me, it's, you know, as I said, come back to the iPhone analogy, it's like, you know, iPhone or Apple and other companies are continually trying to make your phone better rather than you have to take your phone in and ask for a new one. And I think that's what software over the air and feature over the air is, as another conversation, is can allow you to do that.
Feature over the air means you haven't got something and it can be fitted. Right, I've got you.
Yeah, and we're not doing that. Whereas software over the air, we are doing that.
Right, we'll take a very short break and be back with a bit more My Week in Cars with Matt Becker in just a moment.
What car would you buy if you could buy any car? What car would you buy if you knew you could save thousands? What car would you buy if you could compare the latest offers from approved dealers? What car would you buy if you could do all of this in one place in just a few simple clicks? And where would you go to buy that car? What car? Car buying made easy. Visit whatcar.com to buy your next new car.
Hello, welcome back to My Week in Cars with Matt Pry here. Steve Cropley over there and JLR's Matt Becker between us, Vehicle Engineering Director. The man who makes cars feel like they should. Ultimate responsibility for that. How does that, what's the sort of hierarchy of it? How close to the top do you sit?
Oh, Christ. Pretty close, actually. Yeah. So I'm not on the... my title, as I said, yeah, is Vehicle Engineering Director. The one above me is the Board of Directors. So I'm pretty close to...
So you're fairly far up the blame ladder.
I am, basically, yeah. The buck stops. It's not... Yeah, here, basically.
Okay. And across the brands, Defender, Discovery, Range Rover, Jaguar, how you divide your time varies. How's it sitting at the moment?
It's a difficult one because there are so many projects we're working on. But again, and underneath me, the way we've set the teams up is very much brand led. So each of the attribute teams that work for me, there'll be a representative for Range Rover brand, Defender brand, Discovery brand, and Jaguar brand. So basically, I have a direct person I can talk to in each of the departments that work for me that are working on those respective brands. So, and then how much time I deploy on them is really dependent on the status of the development of the project. I can't cut myself in that many sections. No. But it's super critical to have a really strong team underneath you that you can sort of dip in and out of. And I wouldn't say I can do 25%. It really is dependent on the status of the project you're working on. But I try to be as fair and even as I can.
Given that you're not actually designing or engineering the hardware, where would you say that you actually come into a project? And the thing I've always wondered with you is what the sort of percentage is that you can add? Because we get told a lot now that cars are taken to a high degree of finish, whatever I mean, by the computer. But there's always a bit left to be added by people. How much is that?
Huge. I mean, the hardware has to be correct. You have to have the hardware in the right place because otherwise you will... If you rely completely on software, and I kind of sometimes draw a bar graph, that if you've got your foundations that is a third of the 100%, say, bar graph, and then two-thirds is software, you've done it wrong. You have to make sure you've got two-thirds of your foundation of the architecture is correct or beyond two-thirds, and then software is there to manipulate it and, dare I say, tickle it. And in terms of the software influence, well, the software, and this is where JLR are very good. We have a very vast motion control strategy team that are writing a lot of the software. A lot of the software that's created here is not proprietary off the shelf. It's written in-house, and there's many, many thousands of people that are super clever that are writing this control logic, but you still have to, that control logic and that software is still something that the engineers have to be able to, the parameter changes they make is what gives you the end result. It's not like you just apply the software and the job's done. So it's down to the human element to make sure that the software is tuned in the right way.
Give us a view of there's a point where a car gets pretty complete, but then you and your blokes tell people, take it to the Nürburgring or up the back of Wales or somewhere. And that's what I wonder, how much you can add. Is it a lot or is it a little bit?
It is a lot. Yeah, because
so you still talk about damper rates and spring.
Yeah, damper rates and damper rates again is hardware. So you have to create the dampers have to have the range of force velocity in terms of what the range the damper can achieve, but then the software is what manipulates how much of that upper force and lower force do you use. But you still have to put the forces in the right place. If you don't have the bandwidth of a force available to you, then the software
can't operate.
So that's where the hardware side of it, and that's where the super experienced tuning and development team know where the hardware needs to be. And again, but you will come up to the technical limitations of the damping hardware because, you know, you may want the minimum and maximum to be hugely different to what it is, but then you become into the limitations of what the damper can actually achieve. But, you know, you've got active sensitive, you've got E-diff, we've got rear wheel steering, we've got E-pass, we've got torque distribution, we've got torque vectoring, we've got, there's a multitude of things we can develop. And that is why you do see us and the other OEMs go into many, many different locations as well. Yeah. You see us in Sweden, you see us at Nürburgring, you won't see us at IDIADA in Barcelona, but we are there. We're down in Nardo all the time. And there's other locations with JLR products like Moab, where we're doing Rock Crawl, and Eastner, which I'm sure you've all been to, which is a pretty impressive place.
Yeah.
And that's why we go to all these test locations, because you've got that tuning, that bandwidth that tune it available to, you need to go to the location to go tune it.
Give us a bit of a flavour of the durability testing. When you mean durability testing, do you know, I always think born in the middle of Australia, I just think of that as being rough roads, but it's a lot more than that.
Yeah, it is. So we do, there's obviously, you know, PAVE type testing. So we do use Myra as a facility for using some of their extreme events. I mean, some of the robustness testing we do, and where we're, you know, effectively smashing through potholes and pretty
drive things up curves
at speed, you know, curb strike tests, you know, curb steering tests, corrosion tests, cold weather testing, hot weather testing, Dubai. I mean, the sand testing is something that was new to me until 2 years ago, and going to Dubai, and that, wow, that was super impressive.
And that's traction, really?
It's traction, but you have to remember, you know, how hard and arduous it is in a car, because when I went there, I think it was last year, it was 50 degrees, and there's this hill called Big Red. And it was incredible. You sort of look at the hill, like I did when I first went to Sweden. I was like, well, it's never going to go up there. And they just go up there with ease. You look at this Big Red and you think, well, it's definitely not going up there. And it does with ease. But you have to remember, there's, you know, the car is working at super high RPM, super high levels of slip. And all the slip tuning is for, that's why you've got all the different modes on the car. And you've got grass, gravel, snow, you've got sand mode, you've got all sorts of different things, because the slip control requirement for sand is quite different to the slip control requirement for snow. But you have to remember, it's 50 degrees outside. You haven't got that much air flowing through the car, and the car's sitting on the rev limiter going up a sand hill. So that's extreme stuff. That's what we have to do, because the bandwidth of what the car needs to deliver.
So you just do a lot of that more than a buyer would do, and then report.
We go back and there's... JLR is super structured in terms of sign-off and test procedures. Obviously, being a much bigger company than... and I'm not saying the previous companies didn't have test procedures and sign-off procedures. They did. But because of what these cars need to be able to do, is the testing regime is pretty tough and super strict of what is and isn't acceptable.
Do those procedures change? A lot, those sign-off things. I mean, do you come to a new, when you start a new project, to go, actually, the sign-off for this will be X or Y further than previously?
We have categorization of how the cars are categorized in terms of different off-road levels of performance. But generally, most of the thermal ones, no. Most of the thermal ones, it must do minus 40 to plus 50, et cetera, et cetera. So there's generally the foundation of the targets remain the same. Mm. And obviously, going into the Bevolution, we've done a lot of
Bevolution.
We've done a lot of benchmarking of what our competitors are doing to make sure, you know, because it was a new fundament. I know the IPACE has been done a few years ago prior to my time, but, you know, there was an amount of benchmarking that was done then, but obviously things have evolved post that car that we've now done even more benchmarking.
Is the battery electric tech evolving more quickly than combustion tech has done of late? I mean, is it moving so fast that by the time the car is near the end of its life cycle, things have moved on a lot more than it would be the case in the car?
Yeah, I think it is, yeah. I mean, battery technology, EDU technology, efficiency is moving quickly. I mean, things like EU7 emissions is quite a tough thing for us. I mean, people always think of emissions as there's tailpipe emissions. Well, when you remove the tailpipe, the next thing that emits the most thing is tyres and brakes. So now we have to consider, and it's, to be honest, it's easier for some of the smaller manufacturers because once they're below a certain volume, they don't have to yet to be able to meet the EU7 regulations. But as they come on stream, it's things like tyre and brakes emissions, which you need to be respectful of because they're the next components that emit the most.
And with a large car with astonishing performance and bandwidth, tyres come under a bit of strain.
They do, and it becomes a difficult circle because, you know, for range, you're looking for low roller resistance tyres. But when you've got huge levels of torque and performance, you're looking for tyres that have got more grip because you've got all this torque you can deploy. And that's where having some of these clever new traction control systems which we're doing is super important, because if you've got a tyre that has less grip because it needs to, because you've got roller resistance performance targets and you've got range targets you need to meet, then you need to be able to control that slip a lot more accurately.
Do you find that, I was just thinking before when you were talking about bandwidth for 4x4s, do you find that, presumably you must have very close relationships with tyre manufacturers, do you find that they're making as much progress as required? Do you find that do you respect them, or do you wish they'd keep up?
It's interesting because actually next week I'm going to see one of the tyre manufacturers, but they've got the same challenge as us. You know, they want to.
Are they doing as well as you?
I think they are. Yeah, I mean, I think different tyre manufacturers, and I'm not going to name who. Some are doing better than others. But yeah, they have to keep up with our demands, because at the end of the day, although our rolling resistance targets are getting more and more challenging for range and for emissions, they want to deliver products that gives the best overall balance of performance. But it really does, again, come down to the DNA of what the company wants to achieve. So we work super close with them, very closely with them. And to be honest, some of the individuals I work with and some of the tyre manufacturers are people I worked with before in other companies. So you do build a relationship and a rapport with these individuals, tyre companies are super competitive with each other, and they're constantly trying to push each other, and they can't be complacent because they can't fall behind what another tyre manufacturer is doing.
You do find, though, in our job, you find that people like you sometimes, but they don't always issue a press release about it, but they seem to have more respect for one company than another, and I presume that's a moving target sometimes.
Well, it is, but we try and certainly what we did here, and I've done in other companies, try and have a technical partnership with some of the tyre manufacturers and work closely together, because you need to work as a partnership, because if you try and do it in isolation, and you don't want to get into a blame culture with tyre companies.
No.
You just want to work with them.
Yeah.
And the most important thing that I've discovered is, well, the way the world goes around is to have strong relationships with people.
Of course, yeah. The thing that we haven't mentioned yet, but is a gigantic around here, is the emergence of Jaguars. There's going to be a whole... I mean, we're astonished by the fact that what we knew of Jaguar is fundamentally cancelled and replaced by something else. And that goes for the buyers as well, as far as I can see, because the people who want to buy a Jaguar next couldn't necessarily afford one in the old days. Can you give us a flavour of how far you are through developing Jaguars from your point of view, and some of the challenges of working out this DNA? Because we think of Jaguars as being cars with extremely supple rides, not necessarily particularly alert steering in the olden days, but all emphasis on refinement and ride, and presumably that's been replaced by a more modern outlook.
No, I think, I mean, without going to specifics about what we're doing, but a lot of what you've just described is what we're doing. And I'm heavily involved with all of the new Jaguar products.
So you're doing dynamic testing, a lot of dynamic testing already?
We are underway with those products, yeah. Yeah, and yes, we're on the way. We're on the journey.
Does the weight of a BEV, which naturally comes if you want a high range of stuff, add a different set of challenges to development, dynamically particularly?
I think so. But if you have to think about some of the other products I've done, certainly my previous company, you have to engineer in the control weights of a car is what makes a car feel heavy or light.
Okay.
And it's certainly something we always did. I mean, DBX, for instance, it's a car that weighs 2,300 kilos, but you don't know it because of the way the car is tuned and developed. And that is for sure what we're doing in all, you know, drive a Range Rover. Yeah, okay, it's a big, heavy car and it's got a multitude of things it can do. It doesn't feel like a heavy car. So certainly a lot of what me and my team get involved with is to make sure you have to create a car that feels cohesive. And cohesive, I mean that all of the controls match each other. Developing BEVs that are heavier, yeah, for sure, but it's how you tune the car to make it feel lighter. And we talked about all the control systems that are on cars, that those additional tuning levers which we have allows us to make the car kind of almost deny its size and mass.
Mm. Does an electric, I'm trying to think about this, some people say when they talk about like resto mods in particular or electrified modified cars, they go, oh yeah, put an electric motor in an old Rolls suits it, putting one in a 911 or a Ferrari Testarossa doesn't suit it at all. Are there brands or products here that suit it better than that suit electrification better than others?
I think certainly, and as I mentioned earlier about driving the new Range Rover full electric car, I think it really, really suits the car.
Yeah.
And that was driving in Sweden, and I went, as I said, I was in Sweden for 10 days working with the team, and that was kind of really early level development. Because you have to imagine the way development works is you've got all of these, you've got many, many different cars doing development, and you've got all of these teams working together. And then what we do is, and other companies do it as well, is we have what's called an ADV, an attribute demonstrator vehicle. And what that car is there for is to take all of the different vehicles that are being developed and put all of that latest status into one or two cars, which effectively you can call them golden cars as well. And effectively going from Sweden where we're doing the slip control tune, and they went to IDIADA where the dynamics team were doing their first kind of what we call a rough cut of the dynamic setup of the car. And so I drove the car really low mu conditions, low grip conditions, and then at IDIADA we have high grip, which is a handling track, and also we have mid grip, which is a wet handling track. And then we obviously have local roads we could use as well. And I was super impressed of how that propulsion system suits that car. I think I said earlier, it's almost like effortless progression. You know, when you drive a Range Rover, you drive a 500, 1,000 miles, you get out the other end and you feel like you haven't done a 500 or 1,000 miles. I think it adds, with the BEV, it actually adds even more to that because if you demand more throttle, demand more torque, it will give it to you, but it's not overwhelming. It really suits the character of the car.
Is presumably the potential for more accurate wheel control in very low speed traction, difficult traction, is another opportunity for these cars?
It is, because if you imagine, I mean, EVs will give you all of the torque all at once, and having a more accurate traction control system just allows you to manage that deployment of that torque to the contact patch of the tyre. So, yeah, and that opens up new opportunities for us in smoothness of control. And again, what is a Range Rover about? A Range Rover is about smoothness of control, not being bothered, and is exactly what the propulsion system and the integrated traction management system will give us.
Yeah.
How much time do you spend in competitor vehicles?
Well, we have a fleet of them. So
you buy them, do you?
Yeah, we do, yeah. It's quite good with a competitor. There's quite a respect between the industry. I know we can phone up Porsche, BMW, Mercedes, whoever else, and we do car swaps because once a car is launched, it's not a secret what you've done.
Mm.
And actually, it's more cost efficient for actually the individual companies to do car swaps. I mean, it's no secret, Aston are next door to here, quite often swap Range Rovers and Astons, mainly DBX, where we can borrow cars. But that you can only, when you do that, you can, it's a limited amount you can do with the competitor cars. You certainly can't take them apart because that'd be pretty disrespectful to the OEM you'd borrow them off. But what you can do is you can get an indication or of a flavour of what the cars are like. And then once you've done that, and again, working with the product strategy team to understand what your bullseye, we call them bullseye cars, are in terms of competitors, we will then likely purchase the cars because they need to be on site, they need to be available all the time to all the different attribute owners to make sure the good bits we liked about a car they can reference back to say, well, I really like that specific attribute on the car. Therefore, when I go to the different test facilities we go to, we can take them along and reference against them.
Does somebody else ever surprise you?
Not really. I mean, no, I mean, well, we know a Porsche a lot. You drive a Porsche, you know it's a Porsche. And,
yeah.
And you know, we talk about evolution of cars and they're like we are. They're always trying to evolve and make things better. So I don't think anyone does really know.
No, I was sort of mischievously wondering whether they'd done anything with the DBX since you left that you like, that you've seen it improve at all.
Not really. I mean, when you're at a company and you talk about how long it takes to develop a car.
Yeah, yeah, true.
And some of the products that are now coming out from my previous company, well, we were working on
you
those.
You were working,
working on
yeah.
those anyway. So it's, it's a bit... Sometimes I read things that is you don't develop a car in a year. That doesn't happen. It takes, you know, even a mid-cycle facelift of something takes 3 to 4 years. I think I'm just about at the end of the cars now coming out of my previous company, which I no longer would have had any involvement with.
I don't know how happy you are to talk about this. Your favourite cars that you have developed in your career?
I think the first one, I mean, obviously when I was at Lotus, Series 1 Elise was fundamentally done by the very famous John Miles. I worked with him a bit, the ex-Formula 1 driver that's sadly no longer with us. I worked on that car, and that's kind of where I started I was a junior engineer
on
that car.
Were you doing brakes on?
I was doing brakes. So the MMC, metal matrix composite brake system that was on there, I was... a young 22-year-old junior engineer that worked on that car.
That was still a miracle, those things. Brakes that never wore out.
They did, but they had a thermal limitation.
If the car got heavy, wasn't that a problem?
It was the power and the weight. You couldn't really go much above 120 horsepower and 700 kilos because they had a surface temperature limitation.
That's the car you had, Matthew, until about half an hour ago.
I drove one for a few months last year and enjoyed it very much. But and the bloke who looks after it said that the pads are just starting to get hard to find now, I think.
Yeah.
But just such a remarkably lovely car to drive.
Yeah.
Just everything feels right.
Still a moment, isn't it, I think, in car history, that car.
Yeah, it very much is. And I would say cut my teeth on that car. And I was a young engineer that went onto that project. And as I said, worked with Alistair McQueen, John Miles, all of the
proper names.
So I had, and my father as well, obviously. I had sort of good grounding on that car.
And there's a Gavin in there, I guess.
And Gavin, yeah. Well, Gavin and I both started at the same day our apprenticeship in 1980.
This is Gavin Kershaw.
Who is at Lotus effectively with a...
sort of attribute chief.
It's a very similar role, to be honest. So we started...
still mates?
To be honest, I haven't spoken to that much later. We've all got busy lives and we're all here, there and everywhere. Still a mate. But the Elise was the one I sort of cut my teeth on. But in terms of some of the favourite cars I've developed, because the Elise was effectively done... We evolved it for Series 2 Elise and all the other different variants I've done. But Evora has to be one of my...
That was your clean sheet?
My clean sheet car. So that was working with a super small team, super small budget, and trying to take all of my years of learning and experience working with the great people I just mentioned and then turning it into a product that took all that learning and turned it into something that was really good. Unfortunately, I think it was 2008, 2009 when it was launched, when there was the financial crisis at the time. Having said that, I mean, the car did win. I think it did Auto Car Handling Car of the Year.
It did, yeah.
It won that as well. And that for any engineer to engineer and team to win that award was super prestigious. It was a really
had a long life too, that car, didn't it?
It did.
Yeah. But I mean, there are bits of it still under the Emira.
So if I did sneakily look under an Emira not so long ago and recognise quite a lot of the components, and that was stuff that we developed in 2009. I know they've evolved it and they've changed it, but yeah. So I'd say Evora is a very one of my favourite cars. I'd say DBX, because DBX was another sleek, clean sheet of paper car, and the brief at the time for Andy Palmer was pretty clear. Mm-hmm. He sometimes regretted telling me what the brief was, because then I had to lean on him for certain technologies to be in the car, which cost him more money. So it works both ways.
To make it achieve the dynamic targets.
Exactly, yeah. Because it was, you know, when we started the development, it was looking at using passive anti-roll bars. And I said, well, I can't achieve what you want me to achieve unless we have an active sensitive, EDIF, and an active anti-roll bars, which was significant cost to the project. But the only way, again, talk about bandwidth, the only way to get the bandwidth into the car was to have those technologies into the cars. I think they're the first two I would mention. And actually, since it's a toss-up with coming at JLR, it's either the Range Rover Sport SV has been a super interesting project. Again, coming from Aston and having technologies on DBX, when you come to the Range Rover Sport SV, that's got even more technologies on it you can play with. And then on top of that, so it's a toss-up really between Range Rover Sport SV and the Defender Octa we've been developing as well, and the bandwidth of what that car can do.
Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so I've been here, there, and everywhere with that car with the team.
Just define it first. What is it?
It's a Defender on steroids, I would say. Its range of capabilities with some of the technologies it's got on it, because it's got the 6D suspension on it. I can't go into too much detail about anything else on the car, but the way to really appreciate it is to go to the different test locations I've been with it. And okay, so I was in Sweden with it not so long ago, and the car will go anywhere, but it will do it with ease, but with fun. It's super engaging what the car can do. Before Christmas, I was at a place called Les Tours, which is it's actually a world rally course. Happens to be in the centre of a vineyard, which was super useful. It's down near Montpellier. It's a world rally test facility, basically. And I've never done massive jumps in 4x4 cars, and by my word, this thing will do a lot of stuff. It's super impressive what it will do. It's super impressive what the composure the car has.
Is it one of those ones that lands and just doesn't bounce?
It does, yeah. I mean, certainly the 6D suspension with the force authority that system has to be able to stop the car as it lands is super impressive. But it's not just the off-road capability, it's the on-road capability as well. It's a really, again, talking about bandwidth, it's a really, really good car in multitude of conditions. And on the Nürburgring as well. It'll go around the Nürburgring as well. It's a fun machine.
And 6D suspension is the hydraulic.
Yeah, so it's a hydraulic.
That made its debut on the Sport SV.
Exactly. Yeah, and the benefit that has, even take it to another level on the Defender, is the fact you don't have any anti roll bars. You can imagine the articulation, and because we can change the roll pressure, the heave pressure, the pitch pressure. It then opens up this another level of performance we can achieve.
Everything's sort of devolved, so it can have it can be optimized in all those different ways,
basically. So it's that car has done, and Dubai as well, that car has done so much testing here, there, and everywhere because of what it needs to be able to.
Is this a new standard, do you feel, for the mark?
I think so, yeah. I think it is, yeah.
So it'll spread through the cars, I guess.
Possibly. I mean, we have to remember that, you know, the SV team, and okay, this is called Octa, but the SV team is we need to make sure that they still have the ability to make the cars super special. And give them the freedom to do that.
Which is more money.
Well, exactly, yeah. It's a business at the end of the day.
So, yeah.
So. Super. Matthew Becker, thank you very much for joining us.
Should we just...
Oh, go on.
We were going to issue an invitation, weren't we?
Well, yes, I was going to say that the invitation to this year's Britain's Best Driver's Cup is open to you, as always. It's absolutely open to you. So, yeah, do feel free to come along.
I don't know what I did wrong because I got taken off the list.
No, it's just, you became too damn busy. That's a problem. But we'd just like to invite you to bring a Jaguar prototype with you.
Of course you do. Great. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.